Okay, I think we should start because people will wander in, but we're here and let's not lose time, okay? Because it is Sunday, right? Okay, it is my pleasure to welcome everyone here and to give everyone like extra points for coming out on this freezing cold Sunday morning and freezing cold Sunday morning. Just before I start, I want to acknowledge Starbucks. I know this sounds weird, but they donated this coffee, so enjoy it. I think Hakarata, so it's the Starbucks of Shepherd and Bathurst. So if you ever go in there, say, oh, it was so nice of you, you know, to donate it. And then they'll keep donating. So wonderful Jewish learning, right, and support. And it is a pleasure for the second of these wonderful Batei Midrash to introduce Dina Rabinovich. She is on the faculty of Stern College. She has taught at Central and at North Shore. And we just found out we're both our sons know each other, so it's all in the family. And I don't have to. Some of the people here learned with her over Shabbat, and had a wonderful time. And I don't have to say anything more. I'll leave it to her. The wife of King David. Okay.
Good morning. Can I adjust this down? Okay. We're going to start and stop and start and stop. It's a Beit Midrash style shiur, so I want to give you guided questions to think about. I'd like to give you the time to actually think about it. We'll talk about it and then go to the next step. So really the shiur is going to be divided into two different segments. The first where we're going to try and make words into a picture. They say that a picture is worth 1,000 words. We're going to go a little bit backwards and take a few words and try and imagine it as a picture and try and imagine the dynamics between the people in the picture. And after we're done discussing that aspect, we're going to go on to the wives of David, about whom we know more information. And using the literary technique of three and then four, we're going to examine the first three women and compare and contrast them to the fourth. And as we look at the women, we're going to be doing a lot of biblical parallelism and looking at the stories that they remind us of, all to try and build a bigger picture of what we can understand about David and the relationship with each of his wives. So I'll ask you to look at the first source on the page. And really, I've given you the question. I want you to read through the psukim, think about who's appearing here, think about which wives are not appearing here, note when the snapshot is being taken place in the life of David. So I'll just point out that it's while he's in Hebron, it's just after he's moved to Hebron. He had been living in Siklag before that for several years. He will move on to Yerushalayim later on in Shmuel Bet. So that's your goal right now. Really just look at the two sections from the Tanakh. Okay, do we need some more time? Do we have an idea of what's going on? More time? No, that's fine. Just the first two sources from Tanakh, really. The Divrei Hayamim and the Shmuel Bet. Thank you. Okay, how many wives do we see listed here? Using higher mathematics. How many? Six different wives. How many children do we see listed here? Six. What strikes you unusual about this correlation? Okay, only one child is listed per wife, and even more so, the law of averages would dictate that some of the children for some of the wives should be girls. How is it that they each only have one child and each one of their children happens to be male? So we have to think about, is this really all of the children of these women at this time? And if it's not, which it's likely it's not, why are only these sons being listed? Yeah. Correct. We will learn about some of David's daughters and granddaughters just because they get involved and pushed into the action. That's true. But it does help us to think it's not really a family portrait. There seems to be a purpose for this listing. Okay, so we see probably it is a list of people who are could have a chance to become the next king, which then, if you remember my original question, what then are the dynamics that you can imagine between this nice little photograph? It's probably not taken at somebody's bar mitzvah. There's probably a lot of tension going on behind the scenes between the sons, assuming that the oldest son is going to be the heir. How do the other ones react to it? How do they react? The mothers between themselves. Ahinoam, who's the mother of Amnon, was not the first wife of David at all. So there's got to be some tension there. Who, by the way, was the first wife of David? Michal was the first wife of David. And where? But what? Where is she here in this list? She's not exist. She should have been there because she was married to him long before he moved to Ziklag, long before he moved to Hebron. She was actually given away to Palti ben Laish. We'll talk a little bit about that more later. But shouldn't she be listed at all? And what's going on there? Or is it just a list of wives with their children, and that's why she's not going to make the cut? But again, imagine, if you would, she's the daughter of the king, and how she must feel with Ahinoam, who has the son who's the heir presumptive. Yeah. With Michal, there's a major machloket, there's a major conflict. We're going to go into that, in fact, we'll start in a couple of minutes. Yes, but there is a possibility that she is mentioned. We're going to talk about this here, too. Okay, tell me something interesting about Abigail and how she's referred to.
She's referred to as Nabal, the wife of Nabal, who was her first husband.
Right. For some reason, she can't shake off the identity of her first husband. And almost every time we meet her, it's going to be Abigail Eshet Nabal HaKarmeli. And that's pretty significant. Tell me something interesting about Avshalom's mother in the same pasuk. Okay, the wording is slightly different. So who's they're giving the genealogy of the mother, and who is the mother? Okay. What Shevet does she belong to? Slightly trick question over here. Exactly. She's not Jewish at all. She belongs to no. Okay, so Talmai was one of the kings of Geshur, which was on the other side of the Arden, around the Aram Golan area. So what's the next question that we need to ask? How can he marry such a woman? And were there any consequences to the fact that he married her? Okay. So far, two of the women are slightly suspect. There's something unusual about how they're termed. One is referred to by her first husband's name. Another one is referred in conjunction to her father, who's clearly not Jewish. We have two women without any identification at all. Presumably, they're coming from Hebron, and everybody would know of them. Ahinoam, we're told, is coming from the Israel, clearly a prominent family in Yehuda in the south, as was Nabal HaKarmeli. So we clearly see David making alliances with people around him, probably also with Hebron. And then we have the last wife, Egla, and she's the only one who has which designation? Only one declared to be Eshet David, and she has a very unusual name, but there was a question.
No, it was just a comment about that. Like, it seems like a redundant piece of information.
Eshet David. Yes, okay. But because it's redundant, it's going to help give us a wealth of information about what's going on. Okay. In Divrei Hayamim, in the parallel description of David's family, there's a major change. What's the major change between the two? Okay, which is? The name is Daniel instead of Kilav. So we have to ask what happened, which was his original name, and why was he given the second name? This is going to take us to the Mefarshim.
Are these the only children listed in Chronicles and Divrei?
It's not the only section. It's really, I could have copied all the psukim over. I just chose the one that was different. The rest are exactly the same, so I just chose. Really? Yeah. He's the one that's going to be dropping off the map. And that's what's going to be so interesting. Okay, the next thing I want to do is to look at the Mefarshim. And please let me know, should I give you time to work on them on your own and then we'll discuss them? Or would you rather do the Mefarshim together and then when we're comparing and contrasting? Mefarshim are the commentaries. And the commentaries I've translated in English down below. So you could work on the commentaries on your own, and then we can discuss them, or we can do them together, and I can have you work on the next sections. How many would like to do the commentaries on their own? How many would rather do them as a group? Okay, so let's start off by doing some of the commentaries together then. And the first question we're going to ask and to look at is why the discrepancy between the name Daniel and the name Kilav. Rashi and Radak, I brought you both of the commentaries. They're somewhat similar. Radak is just going to give us a drop more information. So I'll read Rashi first and then the Radak. Ubamakom acher hu kore oto umishnehu Daniel. And Rashi informs us, in case we already did not know about the parallel source in Divrei Hayamim, that in another place, Kilav, mentioned in Shmuel, is known as Daniel. V'lamani krashimo Kilav, so then why is his name being called Kilav? Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, shayu litzene hador, omrim, minaval haita Avigail mu'uberet, nehefach klastero v'nidmela aviv. That there were people in the generation, they were mockers, they were those who were making fun. And they were looking at Avigail and her imminent pregnancy soon after she married David and saying, this is not David's child. She was already pregnant from Naval when she married David, because they really did get married pretty soon after. Therefore, in order to quiet these murmurings in a pre-DNA period of life, what did Hashem do? He took the face of Daniel and switched it to really resemble the face of David so nobody would have any doubts about who the father is. I'm going to read Radak and then we'll put it all together. Exactly. Ubisefer Divrei Hayamim Daniel Shnei Shemot Hayulo. Did he have two different names? What's going on? V'yesh bo drash ki lefi shelakach David Avigail achar mot Naval hayu omrim ki meuberet hayta mi Naval. Because he married her so soon after she left Naval, after Naval died, there were those that said that she was pregnant from Naval. V'ze haben shielda Avigail leDavid haya beno shel Naval. And that really, this son was Naval's son. Lefichach yatza klaster panav Klaster Panav Shel David. That's why his face really resembled the face of David. Lahasir Hachashad, to remove all possible doubt. Lefichach Kerao Kilav, Kulo Av. And that's how he got the name Kilav, Kulo Av, totally his father. From head to toe, there is no doubt he looks like his father. Kumar Behol Tsurotav Domela Aviv. And in every aspect, he resembled his father. Daniel Hayash Shemo Haikar. His real name was Daniel. Kiamar Danani Kel Minaval. Because David said, God had judged me from Naval, helped me get rid of my enemy Naval, and this son is proclaiming that to everyone else. And as you noted, it is really reminiscent of the Midrash between Avram and Yitzchak. We see the same sort of fear, the same sort of murmurings amongst the people. And therefore, Hashem did a similar miracle.
How can you compare Abraham and Isaac in this scenario?
Because there's a Midrash with Avram and Yitzchak, the same exact tone of the Midrash, based on the words in the beginning of Parshat Toldot in the parsha that we read, Elatoldot Avraham ben Yitzchak. I'm going to translate it in a minute, okay? Elatoldot Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham holidet Yitzchak. These are the chronologies of Yitzchak, the son of Avraham. Avraham gave birth to Yitzchak. And there, the Midrash will ask, why do we need both? If Yitzchak was the son of Avraham, of course Avraham gave birth to Yitzchak. And it answers that everybody was really in awe. After so many years of marriage, Sarah's suddenly pregnant. She just came home from Avimelech. We bet you that Avimelech is the father. So the repetition is to ensure, yes, Avraham was the father, and the Midrash says that you looked at the face at one and you saw the face of the other, that they were as identical as a father and son could be. So what's happening here with the name Kil Av, because it's a contraction almost, Kulo Av, totally his father, it's a very similar sort of story between the two for similar purposes. There was a doubt about the paternity. Correct. I don't think human demeanors have changed that much. And if you recall, I mentioned that, ironically, he's the only one we don't hear about anymore. What seems to have happened to him? And that's going to be the source, Talmud Bavli. And it's, I don't know why I love this source so much. It's just interesting the different names that come together. Arba'a metu be'itiyo shel nachash. Four people died as a result of the advice of the snake, meaning because the snake enticed Chava to give the apple to Adam, and Adam ate the apple, and death was brought into the world. Four people died as a result of that sin, meaning they had no other sins to their name that were going to cause them to die on their own. That's the only thing. So I like, it's a little bit that way. I just like the fact that these were such innocent people, slightly better than everybody else. And that's what we're going to get to right now, the Elohen. These are the four, Binyamin ben Yaakov, Binyamin the youngest son of Yaakov, Amram avi Moshe, Amram the father of Moshe, Yishai avi David, Yishai the father of David, and Kilav ben David, and this son here as well. And I think one of the reasons that the Midrash talks about that is simply because he disappears. We don't see him anymore in the lineup to become the next king. So if this is a portrait of those who can become the heir, we're going to find a whole story about Amnon and what's going to disqualify him from ultimately becoming the king. He's going to be killed because he rapes his sister, so that puts him out. Kilav is not mentioned at all. We're then going to skip down to Avshalom, who assumes he's going to be the next king. He's going to disqualify himself when he makes his bid to become the next king by rebelling against David. He's going to get killed as a result of that. So he's not going to be the next king. Adoniyahu, who was number four, who's now number one, is going to jockey himself into position, really as David is on his deathbed, and what ultimately makes the next king is that David declares that Shlomo is going to be the one to rule after him and removes all possible doubt. So again, lots of tensions going on in our family portrait over here. But we still need to talk about how on earth could David marry Maacha, what was the scenario, what was his reason, and how was he allowed? So his reason could be for political alliances. We noted that marrying Abigail had a political effect, cementing his relationship with a major family in the south. Possibly marrying Ahinoam could have had that same effect, marrying into somebody from down there. The two wives that we are assuming came from Hebron might have had a similar effect. So let's work with the fact that Maacha, by marrying her, is going to create an alliance with Melech Geshur. It will backfire on him, as many of these political marriages do. His son Shlomo will mimic this behavior in marrying many, many foreign wives, and towards the end of his life, they really undo him. All the alliances he tried to create come back against him, and there are some battles that he has with the very countries that he had become allied to. But could he have married her in the first place? Where did they even meet? And Radak is going to give us the scenario about that. Yes. No. So that's what we're going to talk about right now, how he was able to do this. Presumably they were converting, but there's a little bit more of a twist to the tale with David, and that's exactly what the Radak is going to talk about.
Because we have so much evidence of it. I mean,
I mean, of course, we bolt it en route when we see that in those times, but throughout, you see people marrying non-Jews, so whether it was allowed or not, it seems to have happened.
Yes, it does seem that there was conversion. When we get to talking about Bathsheba in a little bit, there's going to be a major discussion about how David was permitted to be with Bathsheba and ultimately to marry her if she was already married. And there's a discussion there. Was her first husband Jewish or not? Was his conversion legitimate? And if it wasn't, that might have been okay for David, and it gets more into that. But let's look at Macha right now and what the Radak is going to tell us. Darshu bo, and we have a midrash that's going to explain who this is. Lefi shahaya ben yifat toar, that Avshalom was the son of what we call an eshet yifat toar, a captive wife. It will be explained as we continue through the midrash, and then I'll go over it again. Shelakha David b'milchama, that David saw when he went out to war and took her. Leficha chaya Avshalom sorer umore be'aviv, and as a result, Avshalom, the son, rebelled against his father. Lechach nismecha parshat sorer umore leparshat yifat toar, and that is why the two topics are found one right after the other when the mitzvot come up in Sefer Devarim. Lomar lecha kol hanoseh Ota o isha she'ina haguna, to teach us that anyone who weds a captive woman or someone who is not fitting, yotze mimena ben sorer umore, is going to have a child who will rebel against him in the end. Venachon huadrash ki machar shehi shvuya harehi kimuchrachra lashuv ledat Yisrael v'liba lo nachon el hadat. And it's really true, they note, because once she's in the position of being a captive woman, she's almost forced at that point to convert to Judaism, but her heart is really not in the conversion. V'haneta yotze demut hashoresh. And as they say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, that the offspring is going to get those feelings that maybe this isn't the best religion for me. So let me go back and pull it all together. And Eshet Yifat Toar, one of the most complicated mitzvot in the Torah, will allow a man, when he's out to war and sees a beautiful woman who is not Jewish, the right to sleep with her. Whether there's a huge debate in the Gemara whether he's allowed to sleep with her that night or whether he has to wait X amount of time, it seems to make a lot more sense that he's allowed to sleep with her that night. And then should he wish to continue to sleep with her, she has to wait X amount of days, 30 days, undergo a conversion. She also has to make herself deliberately ugly so it's not just a resumption of the lust, to really force him to think about what he's doing. So with this scenario, David would have gone out to war, seen Ma'acha, who was presumably very beautiful. We know that her son Avshalom was extremely good-looking, as was her daughter Tamar. So genetics, that the mother was also very good-looking. David would have seen her and undergone this ritual. The Torah is not in favor of this. It is not an obligation. When you go out to war, you must behave in such a fashion. It's more, this is an unfortunate aspect of human nature and warfare. Let's try and make it as better as we can under such terrible circumstances. So under this rubric, David would have met Macha, brought her back to home, and married her. But clearly the Torah is not in favor of it, as the Radak notes, as the different commentators note in Sefer Devarim, where the law appears, because the topic that follows Eshet Yifat Toar, the laws of a captive wife, are the laws of a rebellious son. The rebellious son, again, a really hard mitzvah, that you see a son going on a certain pattern of behavior, and before he can get all the way to really committing a terrible crime, you're going to bring him to Beit Din and put him to death. So you have to imagine how terrible the situation is going to be, that a parent will turn their own child over. There are those that say this never, ever officially occurred, but they're going to use the title, the description, to describe certain forms of behavior, and they're going to say that Avshalom, the son of David and Macha, exhibited traits of a ben sorer umore, a rebellious son, and we know for a fact that he does rebel against his father and commit some heinous crimes as a results of this rebellion. So we were asking, how was David permitted to marry Macha? So either as part of a political alliance where she would have converted, or under the rubric of Eshet Yifat Toar, this captive wife. Either way, they're going to be very devastating consequences for David in having to deal with Avshalom later. There's a lot that happens. Okay. turning the page.
Do we have awards taking place in this room?
Yes, there were a lot of awards. I couldn't pinpoint exactly when in Geshur. Later on, he's going to fight with Aram and Ammon. Beforehand, there were a lot of battles that were constantly going on that he was fighting. Shaul was sending him out to war against, and he was in that area, definitely. Yishai is the son. Give me a second. I actually have it here.
Obed,
who's the son of Boaz. Thank you.
Obed.
Who's the son of Boaz, who married Ruth.
So, in English, Jesse would be the son of Boaz?
Jesse would be the son of, grandson of Boaz, yes. Okay? And the Midrash Tanhuma is just going to succinctly put together what the Radak was talking about, really one of Radak's sources. Al shechamad et macha batalmi melch Geshur betzitola milchama yetzami menu avshalom shibikesh lahargo. Almost a payback, because he lusted after Macha, the daughter of King Talmai, when he went out to war. From this union came out Avshalom, who desired to kill him. Okay, so we've talked briefly about Abigail, we've talked briefly about Macha. We're going to now look at Eglah and also question her name, as I always like to tell my students, especially the male ones. I don't recommend you follow the advice and call your wife a cow. However, it does seem to have been a term of endearment. And if you look at the Shoftim source, it's actually the third pasuk on the page, we see Shimshon referring to his newly married wife as Eglah, as a calf. And the scenario is, his friends are trying to get him to tell the secret. He had posed a riddle about something that had happened to him on the way down to the wedding, and nobody could ever figure out this riddle unless you knew that he had killed the lion, and in the lion's carcass there was a hive of bees, and now there's honey from it. There was no way anybody could figure it out. His wife begged him to tell her what the answer to the riddle was, so she could then tell the others and they could all claim the prize together. And Shimshon is very upset. Vayamrulo anshei ha'ir b'yom ha'shvi'i b'terem yavo ha'charsa mama tok midvash u'me'az me'ari. And at the last possible minute, almost like this Rumpelstiltskin story where she's giving the name, at the last possible moment, just as the sun is setting, what is sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion? That is the answer to your riddle. Vayomer lahem, and he says in despair and dismay, Lulei charashtem be'eglati, lo metzatem chidati. Had you not plowed my heifer, had you not asked my wife the answer to this question, you would not have discovered my riddle. So again, interesting that Eglah could be this very unique term of endearment by which a husband would refer to a wife.
So what I answer to the riddle?
She just had her hand up, yeah?
I would not say that this usage is a term of endearment. This is, I think, to me, it's derogatory.
So I'm just going to repeat the question so they can hear it. You would see it as a derogatory term. I hear that, except it seems to be that every time I hear this story quoted, it's always that Eglah is a term of endearment, and it's quoted in a number of different places. I think he does find her very dear to him, and he's just hurt by it. I do think it's not a derogatory term. So we have that Eglah would therefore seem to be a wife that he valued above all others, but we still don't know who she is. Yes. He had asked that's actually the answer to the riddle. The question was that from something strong came out something sweet. And what could possibly be that?
What is stronger than a lion? That if you had not plowed with my heifer, you had not found out my riddle.
Right. So again, it's referring to the fact that on his way down to marry his wife, when he went to meet her, he found a lion who was about to attack him, and he kills the lion. When he comes back, actually, for the nuptials, he finds that in that lion's carcass that he had killed a while ago, there's now a hive of bees producing honey.
Right.
So the question that he posed everybody, what comes from the strong that's now sweet?
So what's the answer?
that from the lion, which is strong, there's now this hive of bees producing honey, which is sweet.
So when the answer is a question.
Right.
So when the question, he answers it. Yeah. And he called, in my opinion, he's calling his wife a cow.
Yes, definitely.
That's terrible. So what kind of nice bees?
So that's what, I'm sorry, I don't know your name?
Shana
was saying the same thing, and actually it's viewed as a term of endearment, which I don't presume to understand, but that's how it's viewed at the time.
Well, my answer to that would be, that makes perfect sense, except that Shimshon was such a diss when it came to he had no insight.
Okay. So that Shimshon didn't know how to treat women well, and this is just a further proof to it. Okay, I like that one. So now we still have to figure out who Eglah is, which one of his wives could possibly, let's just accept right now that Eglah is this term of endearment, whatever we think about it, which one of his wives would warrant that designation. The other clue was Eshet David. The only one of the six listed as Eshet David was Eglah. And if you look at the other two sources, we see one wife, and again, it's the only wife that has a designation of Eshet David, the two above the Shoftim source. Which wife is known as Eshet David? Michal is known as Eshet David. Ironically, when in the first source, B'Shaul Natan et Michal Bito Eshet David, the Palti Ben Laish Asher Migalim, as Shaul is taking Michal away from David and giving her over to another man, she's referred to as Eshet David. And the reverse is true. When David is taking Michal back from Palti Ben Laish, he refers to David, to Michal as Ishti, Vaishlach David Melachim, Elishboshet Ben Shaul, Emor Tna et Ishti, et Michal, Asher Erasti Li Bemea Orlot Plishtim, bring me back my wife Michal. So using if A equals B and B equals C, if Eshet David is Michal, and if Eshet David is Eglah, and Eglah seems to be this very dear wife, presumably wife number six is Michal. Problem with that is... Oh, totally. We're going to talk about that when we get to the more BEU and about Michal. Yes. Michal was not very dear to David because
they quarreled. They had a very bitter life together. She was a spy against him in his own household for her father. She criticized him. Not a happy marriage.
She protects him in the beginning. She criticizes him a lot at the end. When she first meets David, again, as we will see, there's almost a starstruck love that she has on her part for David. The question is, was it reciprocated or not? This is almost implying that David felt very strongly about Michal as well. It's a midrash. It's one suggestion. I'm not sure that that plays out. It appears to me that really he married Michal, again, for the political alliance, just as he's marrying Macha, just as he married Abigail, just as he married Achinoam. How does it help him? If he knows that he's going to be the next king, what better way to help cement himself as a new king than by marrying the daughter of the previous king, and suddenly this union will have any much more strength to stand on. But it does seem here a little bit that this is one way of showing that it was a two-sided relationship, not one-sided, though I do agree that it was not a peaceful union.
I mean, she should be the first wife, because Michal was his first wife. So that's kind of the problem.
Okay, let me just repeat the question so we can hear it, that if so, Michal should be listed as the first wife.
But I would say, but I'm just, when you say that, you know, in terms of why Davi pursues her,
you know what, can I bring this over to her to talk so that we can do it this way, so we can hear the question?
Would that be okay?
I just think it's more natural than my always having to repeat things.
I was just saying that when you look at the sources, the fact that you have, you know, that initially David marries her after he kills, you know, the Philistines, and then Saul, when he's mad at David, gives her away, and it's to Palti. But it's only natural for David to want her back, not necessarily for affectionate reasons, whether they were started. It's only who would want, I mean, it was a terrible thing for Saul to give her away. And, of course, he would look weak if he allowed that to stay that way, right, rather than...
So it's definitely a political ploy at the time. He's cementing his kingship in Hebron. He's getting ready, ultimately, he will want to conquer Yerushalayim. He will want to move the Yaron there. And again, he wants the support of the royal family. There is one son of Shaul who survived the end of Shmuel Aleph, Ishbosheth, who is a parallel king, very weak, but his chief of staff, Avner, is very strong. And for David to try and show that I'm really the king and I have the support of Ishbosheth's family, what better way than by bringing Michal back? You mentioned that she really should be first, but what was the order in which the wives were listed? The order of sons. So even though she married earlier, if she had a child, it would have been later. We do know that Michal definitely had fertility issues that will come up later when we talk about Michal and compare and contrast her to Rachel. But you had mentioned something else earlier about Michal that really questions, is she Egla? Going in line with the fertility issues that... It says that she doesn't have any children, so how is it possible that she has a child at this point? It says, and again, we'll see this pasuk in a little bit, that she didn't have any children until the day she died. So the way that we can answer that is as follows. So if you look at the Radak, well, Radak is going to talk a little bit about it, and then we'll talk more. Darshu Razal, Egla zo Michal bat Shaul, v'lefish haita chaviva al David kara'a Egla, kemo lulei cherashtem be'eglati lo metzatem chayidati. Razal explained that Egla is really Michal, and because she was dear to David, he called her Egla, quoting, learning from the Shimshon Pasuk, if you had not plowed my calf, you wouldn't have found out the answer to my riddle. Uma she'amar eshet David mesayeya hadrash, ela lefish haita ishto rishona. She's called the wife of David because she was really the first wife, and that's why she gets the designation. In terms of having a child, the answer is that possibly she had one before the episode that the pasuk is going to tell us. She didn't have any children. From that day on, she didn't have any children. Another possibility will be she didn't have children until she died. She had a child as she was giving birth. So... Yes, I said it the other way. Thank you. She died in childbirth, again, coming into another parallel with her matriarch, Rachel. Okay, that concludes the snapshot that we have, the six wives, the six sons, all possible contenders. One interesting insight I read from Rabbi David Silber about Naval, about Abigail, and about Kilav. We mentioned that a very positive midrash, that Kilav died young through no fault of his own, and that's why he disappears. Rabbi Silber posits that Abigail really was pregnant with Naval when she married David, and that's why he disappears from all the stories, because he's definitely not a contender. He's obviously looking at the pshat, not at the midrash, but it's an interesting insight into further what is going on. Okay, what we're going to do now, we're going to examine more closely four wives or four partners of David about whom we know more information. We're going to look at Michal, we're going to look at Abigail, we're going to look at Bathsheba, and we're going to look at the fourth, which is going to break the pattern, break the mold, Avishag. Avishag was not a wife. He never married her. He never slept with her. She functioned as a bed warmer during the last years of his life when he was suffering from this intense coldness and nothing else would help him get warm. So what I'm going to ask you to do right now is to look at the sources. You can see that I've given questions to guide you along, and I think it will be easier for us if we tackle one wife at a time. So first I'm going to ask you to look at the psukim about Michal and to think about how Michal is like Rachel. If Michal is like Rachel, how do the other characters in the story match up? Who is David going to be compared to? Who is Yaakov going to be compared to? Who is Lavan going to be compared to? What can we learn from those matchups? If we're now comparing David to Yaakov, what does that tell us? How is the relationship that Yaakov had with Rachel the same or different from the relationship that David had with Michal? Okay? I've given you some words to look at as you're going through this, and you'll let me know when we can begin to discuss again. Okay, if we can come back together a little bit and talk about what we found with some of the similarities between the two different stories. Okay, so similarity number one, let me hear from you, and I'll try and remember to repeat this into the mic. What are some of the similarities between the two stories? Yeah. Okay, so the fact that there is a two-sister team where the husband is slated to marry either or both and winds up marrying a different one than he anticipated originally. So Yaakov wanted to marry Rachel and instead winds up with Leah and then has to marry Rachel afterwards, a switcheroo having been done the night of the wedding. Shaul was ready to give Merav, the oldest sister, to David. David refuses. He gives her to Adriel ben Hamecholati, and instead he's going to offer Michal under conditions that David is ready to assume rather than ambiguously fighting Milchamot Hashem, wars of God, with no end in sight, an impossible situation. He accepts the challenge in order to marry Michal to kill 100 Plishtim. He does that. He marries Michal. To further complicate matters, it looks like Michal marries the one that Merav had married earlier on. So we have this triangle, two sisters and a husband in both of the stories. Okay. We have either evil fathers-in-law with Rachel and Leah, their father, Yaakov's father-in-law is Lavan. And what's interesting then, what does it inform us about the David and Michal story? Who's the evil father-in-law? Shaul, which says a not so positive light on Melech Shaul, which really, I mean, he's playing around with his daughter's life and really trying to kill David. With both his daughters, yes. Keep going.
The element of deceit in both stories. In the first story, Lavan is deceiving Yaakov by giving him Leah instead of Rachel. There's also another element of deceit in the story, so that's father towards future son-in-law. But there's also the element of Rachel deceiving Lavan by taking the Tarfim and sitting on them and not allowing him to find them. Although the word Rimitani is not used in that, it's only used with respect to Lavan towards Yaakov, not use in the words of Rachel. It says she stole them, but it doesn't use the word Rimitani.
Okay, yes.
And then in the second story, Michal is deceiving her father Shaul by allowing David to escape, and there is the use of the word Rimitani.
So we have a double language parallel with the word Trafim that are found in both stories. Rachel takes the Trafim of her father, hides them as she's running away. The Trafim seem to have two different uses. Again, we extrapolate from these stories what the Trafim were used for. Use number one, they seem to be some sort of fertility device. Whether it was true or not, it seems to have been the perception of women who had a hard time conceiving that they would have Trafim. And that's almost a backwards argument because Rachel has them and Michal has them and they both had a hard time conceiving. Ergo, we see that it seemed to have had a fertility perception to it. The other aspect of Trafim is that Rachel thought that they could have some sort of divination, tell Lavan where they were going, which will help explain why she's stealing them so that her father will not know where Yaakov and the family have run off to. So both stories feature Trafim. Both times the Trafim are used deceitfully. Rachel will lie about the fact that she has stolen them. Michal uses them to put under covers to make pretend that David is still asleep in the house, so that Shaul won't be able to kill him. So both times the Trafim are to try and help the husband escape from the father-in-law. It obviously backfires with Rachel because Yaakov is so sure that nobody stole the Trafim, he vows that whoever has done so will die, not knowing that that person is Rachel, and she will indeed die shortly thereafter. The assumption is at this point she's already pregnant with Benjamin, and as they cross over into the actual land of Israel, as they're approaching Beit Lechem, she gives birth to Binyamin and dies in childbirth. So the use
use of the word trafim, the use of the word to deceive, rimitani, is unique to both of these stories, and these are both words that are not very common in Tanakh. Yeah. Okay, the groom ends up paying double the bride price. Explain with Yaakov.
Yaakov, he works 7 years theoretically for Rachel, but Lo is Leah, and so he ends up working another 7 years, although he gets married immediately, but he has to work another 7 years.
So let me just do this for the sake of the mic, that Yaakov has to work 7 years twice. The first time he thinks it's for Rachel, but he doesn't. He gets Leah, so he has to work another 7 years. And with David, Shaul asks for 100 foreskins of the Plishtim, meaning he's killed the Plishtim in order to get that donation, and he kills 200 instead. Good. Did he know that Rachel stole the Trafim? I'm not sure. I think at some point he might have known, but I can't. Right, but did he sense it when she died? That's what I'm wondering. There was just a lot of grief over her death. It was his beloved wife, but possibly the element of grief also suggests that he thought that as well. Not that I'm aware of. How would stealing the Trafim have helped them escape Lavan if they were indeed a source of divination, or if they were perceived to be divination, that you'd be able to see where somebody is going to or where somebody has run away to, almost like the magical ball in The Wizard of Oz. That's the image I have in my mind. So if she removes this, she doesn't... So that becomes a major question, how much existed in the household of Yaakov and whether that's good or not. There's actually a pasuk that talks about Hashem telling him to get rid of his avodah zarah as he's getting ready to cross over into Eretz Yisrael. We can also ask about Yaakov, how can he exist in a family of arayot, having married two sisters? And Ramban has a very interesting answer for that outside of Eretz Yisrael was one thing. It's certainly not great, but it existed. By the time Yaakov is crossing over into the land of Israel, he's no longer living with both wives. Rachel is at the end of her term of pregnancy, so presumably he's not living with her as husband and wife at that point. And as soon as she gives birth, she dies. Arayot would have been commanded as Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach.
But the whole point of Abraham is that he figured out God.
Right. Okay, so there are different gradations of Avodah Zarah. I'm not advocating the use of Trafim at all, but it was considered a much lower level. It was almost an aid to things as opposed to hardcore Avodah Zarah. So it doesn't necessarily condone it, but it might help explain how it could be there. Also, she's coming from a society in which this existed, and removing it also, could it be that she didn't advocate the use as much and she just wanted to make sure her father didn't have it? So that could be another way of explaining the situation.
I'm here. I can see. No, there is that theory that she took the idols because she didn't want her father to have the idols. I mean, all of that is conjecture. It's also more bothersome that Michal had idols. You know, I mean, this is years later. But I think we see all the way through Tanakh, there was rarely a time when there wasn't some form of, where they're constantly being told to get rid of the idols, to get rid of the Asherahs, all of that, right?
I think the fact that Yaakov was able to make that kind of extreme vow means that this was all being done completely behind his back, because this would have been abhorrent to him.
Yes. Very much so. Okay, so let's go through some of the similarities and see what we can learn about them. We talked about the Trafim. We talked about the illness aspect, Rachel pretended to be ill. That's why she couldn't get up from where she was sitting, because she was really hiding the trafim. Michal pretended that David was ill, which is why you couldn't go and wake him up. Really, it was a trafim instead of David.
I was just going to say, in the love piece, with Rachel and Leah, with Rachel and Yaakov, they seem to love each other, but we're never told that David loves Michal.
We're going to get to that in exactly a minute, because the comparisons will help highlight the differences. We see the worth of the word rimitani, tricking. We see the switcheroo. One daughter is promised and another is going to be substituted in. We see that the men have connections with both of the daughters, the older sister and the younger sister. It's a slightly different relationship, but the fact that it exists is another parallel. There's a sense of waiting. Yaakov is going to have to wait until he's finally able to marry Rachel. David is going to have to wait a certain amount of time until he's going to be marrying Michal. We also see extreme emotions between the husband and wife. We see Yaakov and Rachel arguing. Rachel has initiated, how come you're not davening for me, praying for me to have any children, like your father did, like your grandfather did. With Michal, it's a little bit different. She doesn't like David's behavior. She doesn't think he's behaving royal enough, and she gets very upset with him as well. Both Michal and Rachel seem to die in childbirth. Rachel, it's in the Pshat. Michal, it's more of a Midrash, but it's again an interesting enough correlation between the two women. And we can't forget that Michal is from Shevet Binyamin, a descendant of Rachel. With all of those things in place, what can we now learn about Michal to help us understand her relationship with David because of so many parallels? And that's exactly what you were saying. The fact that Yaakov and Rachel seem to have a really mutual affection for one another. We're told that Yaakov loved Rachel, and we see a lot of Rachel interacting with Yaakov as well, a much more stable relationship. With Michal, we also see the idea of love, but here it's clearly on Michal's side, Ve'yahav Michal et David. Michal loved David. Nowhere are we told that David had reciprocal relationships with Michal. It seems to have been much more of a political relationship. Again, we just spent a few minutes in the beginning of our time together talking about that David really liked Michal, which is why she's called Egla, which is why she's called Eshet David. But in the Pshat, we don't necessarily see this mutual relationship where both have an equal footing. It always is appearing that Michal wants to connect with David. There's something very romantic to her in the figure of who David is that she wants to align herself with. And it becomes very sad towards the end. It's almost as if she's marrying David because of who he is. He's a shepherd. He's strong. He's musical. Admoni, he's just reflecting good health everywhere he turns. And Michal seems to be much more rigid, not showing emotion, following her father, Shaul, in that way as well. And there's something about David that attracts her very much. But as is too often the case, she marries him wanting him to change. And when he exhibits that same behavior, when he's so excited that the Aron is being brought to Yerushalayim, when he can't control his joy and he's singing and he's dancing with everyone else, she's going to look at him like, how can a king behave that way? You should be restrained. You should be dignified. You should not be showing emotion. And she gets very upset with him. What's also interesting to note and to help create this picture really of a lonely, forlorn princess is the use of the window that we see in a few times with Michal. She's sending David out the window to help him escape. I always think of a Rapunzel type of story where she's left behind. Rachel is helping Yaakov escape as well, but she's running away with Michal, with Yaakov. They're starting a life together. Michal is helping David, but she's going to have to stay behind. She's not going to be going off with David. Not only does she stay behind, but she's ultimately going to be given by someone else. Really a very passive woman looking out the window as life is passing her by. And again, when she sees David dancing and she gets so upset at his behavior, she's looking out that window again, watching life, not really a part of it.
I think in general the use of a chalon, window, in Tanakh is always something significant. It's almost like a double-edged sword here. She's using the window to save David. In the end, she feels deceived or feels, you know, that, what did I do? Why did I save him? I see what how he's acting. We see that it reminds me of the Meraglim that were saved, that they were let out the window, and then later you see Aim Sisra looking out that window, waiting for her son to come back, and in essence, he's dead. Right. So,
and she's willing to wait for him because she thinks it's good what he's doing, looting all the people on the field after he's killed them.
Is Michal just so upset because David is dancing and exhibiting emotion, or is it more than that? Because by now we know he's already got all these other women in his life. Is it jealousy over all these other wives? Maybe he's dancing with them.
Okay, we don't see the other women listed in the scenario. Could she be jealous of him? I'm going to say yes and no. Yes, because maybe not so much that he has other wives. I think it was more established for kings to have other wives. It's a question of whether having multiple wives was common at the time or just for royalty. Certainly for royalty, it seems to be accepted. And indeed, from David, we learned that a king can have up to 18 wives. What might have hurt her more, and again, I'm just assuming here, the fact that she didn't have children, that really what would have cemented her position in the royal family as the first wife would be to be the mother of the first son. So I think that combination certainly helps these feelings of jealousy. And again, part of the reason I'm extrapolating that, just because she's so similar to Rachel, and we see that so clearly with Rachel, I'm going to put elements of that story onto the Michal story to help me understand her better.
But in terms of her despising David, I mean, you know, in 16 there, it's very, very clear that David, she sees David dancing, but to her it's, you know, he's acting we've always learned, you know, he's leaping, he's dancing, whatever he's doing, what to her seems inappropriate. I mean, right, and then right after, that's a vase low. That there seems to be a direct correlation between what he's doing and her reaction to it. So I think, I mean, we can read all kinds of things into it, but right there in the sources, I think there's a direct connection to the way he's acting with the ark and her reaction. Like,
just on the question of jealousy, I don't think we have it here, but if I remember the original text correctly, doesn't she then go on to say to him, you know, aren't you proud of yourself? You're showing off in front of the housemaids. Which, I mean, you could read that as being a question of status and position being used inappropriately. You can also read it, I think, on a sexual level.
Okay, yeah. But I would just read it more with a derision in her tone. I don't think it was as calmly said. I think she was mocking him. Look at how you're conducting yourself, very inappropriately.
Also, could it not be also a before and after Michal? Michal at the beginning loving David, but then she had this other relationship with Palti Ben Laish, and we don't really know what that relationship was like. And then she comes back to David. How do we know how she feels about David at this point? I mean, she's already had a relationship with somebody else, so.
Rav Adin Steinsaltz has this beautiful essay on Michal, and he notes that once she comes back, she's almost totally quiet. The only time we hear her is when she's mocking David in this last scene. But it's almost as if all the power has been taken away from her. She's almost been given to David, but at least there she seems to have had a say in the matter. But then she's taken away from David, really a pawn, and given to this other person, and then taken from Palti and given back. And whatever personality may be, say in her own life, she seems not to have anymore. So, yeah, I think that's there. Did you have a question?
It's so common that David's response to her, from David's response to her, it seems that the conflict between them, the way I'm reading it, is more an issue of Beit Shaul and Beit David. And maybe there's a sense that Michal, at the beginning of her life, it was love that drew her to him, but now there's a sense of being repelled from the fact that now a realization that you've taken over that line. Because what does David say? He says,
Ki bachar bi me'avicha mikol beito. It's a sense of there's that realization that you have usurped the power from my family, and David is kind of rubbing it in her face. Yes, now I'm taking over. So that tension between the two.
Yes, I think the feeling of rejection there, who she is and what her family represents. I would say both. I would say on all levels. There is the personal sense, and there is that more family who I'm representing sense that you're rejecting all of it, and you seem to be much more successful than my father is. But my father was right. My father's my father. This is how he conducted himself. And almost a slap in her face on so many different levels. Okay, if you can look with me, the Midrash Shmuel, it's on the end of page 6. Let's just go through the Mefarshim quickly, and then we'll transition over to Abigail. Tani, shalosh nashim metu chayot. Three women died in childbirth. Imenu Rachel, wife of Yaakov, our foremother. Kalato shel Eli, the daughter-in-law of Eli. Umichal bat Shaul, Michal, the daughter of Shaul. As it says, ulumichal bat Shaul lo hayala vlad ad yom mota. We don't have a death scene as we do with the other two women, where literally they're in labor and they are dying as they are naming their child, or their child is being named. But we have the pasuk that she did not have a child until the day that she died. Amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Simon, ad yom mota lo hayala biyom mota hayala. That if we read the pasuk very carefully, she did not have a child until the day that she died, that on the day that she died, she did indeed give birth to a child. Hadahu dichtiv v'hashishi yitra'am le'egla, which is why the pasuk can tell us, and the sixth was Yitra'am born to Egla. The sixth child of David was Yitra'am born to Egla. V'lama nikra shema Egla, amar Rabbi Yehuda bar Rav Simon, al shepua umeta ke'egla. And here we have another reason, Shana. I think you're going to like this reason for the name Egla a little bit better. Why was she called Egla? Because she cried out and died like a cow. Okay?
How do all these people, how do they... They deal with all of this that she died giving birth, and yet we've just read in Shmuel Beit, in verse 8, that she had five children from a third husband.
Okay, so presumably that third those children were not from her, that were really her sisters. And as I said, I'm not sure chronologically when this timing would have been. These are Midrashim trying to make sense, and there are different families of Midrashim, so we don't necessarily have to put them together, but it is a question I have as well. Upershu Razal, I'm looking at the Radak. Upershu Razal mahayom hahu ve'elach lo hayala lo onesh ma she'amra aval lifnei hayom hazeh hayala keman shekatuv yitra'am le'egla eshet David v'amru egla zo michal. And another way of looking at the phrase, she did not have a child until the day that she died, from that point on, from the point where she's making fun of David as he's bringing the Aron to Yerushalayim, she didn't have a child. It says nothing about the time beforehand. Beforehand, she did have a child. And again, using the same pasuk as a proof, the fact that Yitra'am is born to Egla, who is Michal. So two different ways of looking whether or not Michal had a child. Okay, so we've looked at Michal. We're moving on to Abigail right now. Abigail is David's second wife. She's the one who's listed as the wife of Nabal HaKarmeli. As we look through the psukim here, we're going to line people up again. Keep in mind, please, that if you switch around the word, the letters of Nabal, you get Lavan. There's going to be a lot of similarities between them. Line up the characters as well. If Abigail is going to be compared again to Rachel, that's going to be an interesting correlation. But what's going to make it interesting is that at some point, Abigail is going to be compared to Yaakov. When Yaakov is bringing gifts to Esav, it's going to be seen as Abigail bringing gifts to David, which means that who else is lining up? David and Esav. So think about that as you go through the sources. There are even more striking parallels between David and Esav. What can we learn from the fact that they are going to compare one to another? How is David, in fact, similar to Esav? How is he similar to Yaakov? And where does Abigail play into it? I also gave you some sukkim about Rut, because the chesed that Abigail does is going to remind us of the chesed that Rut does, Ruth being David's great grandmother. So it's all one big circle. I'd like to start just so that I can give you a little bit of time each time we're going around to look at the sources on your own. So first let's look at the Yaakov and David parallels Rachel and Abigail. In both stories, what are David and Yaakov doing? What is their connection to sheep? I might be giving it away a little bit too much that way, but I'm not quite sure how else to direct you to the right area. What is... So sheep and shearing, David's men are watching over Nabal's flocks to protect them from outside enemies as they are roaming all winter long. When we meet Nabal, he is throwing this huge party celebrating the sheer sheeping, the successful flock that he now has. Yaakov is in charge of Laban's flock, and it is due to Yaakov's diligence in watching over the sheep that Laban has a successful flock as well. Nabal refuses to compensate David's men for their time and effort. Who is David? Who is he coming to say that his men should eat from this party that I'm throwing? Really talking very chutzpahdically about David, whom he knows, people know at this time that David is going to become king, so the way he's treating David is really inappropriate. Laban similarly treats Yaakov with an inappropriateness. When Yaakov is asking for the wages that he has justly earned for the last 6 years watching over Laban's flocks, Laban goes out of his way to trick him with the whole story with the sheep. You can take the spotted sheep and then hiding the spotted sheep, and then Yaakov somehow gets the sheep to give birth to spotted sheep in one of these very interesting stories about genetics. But the similarities, sheep and being tricked through sheep and watching over sheep and not getting paid adequately for what you are doing. Okay. David and Esav, how are they similar? So the number 400 appears in both stories. When Yaakov is going to meet Esav, Esav has 400 men. That parallels the amount of men that are in David's main army. He'll have 200 also others at different times, but really 400 seem to be the ones who are fighting. What about the initial description? The first time we meet David, the first time we meet Esav. Yeah? Admoni, ruddy in complexion. You sometimes think it's red hair. It seems to be more red face, a picture of good health. They're both outdoorsmen. They're both very strong. They both live off of murder. It's a very harsh thing to say about David HaMelech, the same David who wrote such beautiful Mizmorei Tehillim, who wrote such beautiful psalms, who was such a beautiful musician in the court of Shaul. He was a warrior. He was a soldier. He lived by killing people, which is the aspect of Esav that we put down. What becomes interesting is that while it has a negative side to it, David certainly takes this aspect and makes it positive. The wars that he's fighting are to protect the nation of Israel, to protect Am Yisrael. The people that he's killing are the enemies of Yisrael. So he's clearly taking this aspect, this outdoorsman, this hunter aspect, and using it for something positive. In the story that we see him with Abigail is one time where that aspect is sitting on the fence, and it's in question. And he wants to take revenge on Nabal for Nabal's lack of appreciation, for Nabal's really chutzpah. Response, who is David, who is Ben Yishai, treating him as lower than the low when David was doing this tremendous favor for him, when David was really acting as a king on his behalf? And this is where the story becomes interesting. David could have lowered himself into acting like Esav by killing Nabal. There was a right in his killing Nabal. If Nabal behaved with such chutzpah, if he was so inappropriate to David, David, in his role as king, can deal with that by killing the person. There was a legitimate ground for him to kill Nabal. What's interesting is that Abigail steps into the picture and convinces David, don't act like Esav. Admoni is fine in some places. You need a certain element to be the successful leader. But don't fall completely into the trap of becoming an Esav. Let Hashem fight this war for you. Have patience and Hashem will take care of it.
You say don't act like Esav. Where is Esav doing anything wrong? That's basically where is he working? When he comes to his brother, dying so bad to him, and to come with kiss and forgiveness. We have an image of Esav, but we're in the chat.
And I was just going to, again, and if you really look at it and forget all of what we learned in nursery school and on, where Esav is always painted in a very black way, he shows great respect for his parents. He does what he's told. He's honest. He buys it. He upholds his end of the bargain. And so Yaakov's coming back. Esav hears that he's coming back with a large group of people. He has every right to defend himself. And then even though we read into, you know, he hugs him, he wanted, you know, I mean, all we read all these things into it. In the actual verses, you don't see that what we ascribe to him over the centuries, you know.
So Nechama Leibovitz has an interesting point on this. She makes a distinction between Esav the human being and Esav the archetype. And so she talks about the idea that the Esav that we all grew up with, that's the archetypal Esav. And that's why all the rabbinic commentaries support that idea, because they perceive Esav as the forerunner of this historical archetype. But that in the text, not present so much. Really, the only moment where the Esav the murderous appears is when he says, Daddy's funeral is coming soon, and then I'll kill my brother. But until that moment, I think you're right.
Right, and the only other thing is that Kitzayid Befiv, that he's this hunter, he has this natural tendency. It might be directed against animals at this point, and again later on, his descendants against people, but that there is this tendency, he's more the outdoors man. Okay, so Abigail is then able to take David, who's sitting on this fence right now, how am I acting, and has him behave more like Yaakov rather than Esav. What's interesting, I think, if we're looking at Abigail versus Michal, when Michal tells him to behave a certain way, he pushes her aside. He won't listen to her at all. When Abigail tells him to behave a certain way, he's able to listen to her advice. He respects who she is. She's in the Isha Chachama. She's a wise woman. He recognizes that. She's also a beautiful woman. We have seen that David seems to surround himself with beauty. Certainly, music is important to him. Poetry is important to him. It seems that aesthetically, he is attracted to beauty as well, but that there's more of an equal standing in his relationship with Abigail, the little bit we see them interacting. And this is really the sum total. She's mentioned from here to there, but really Kilav's father and then is going to disappear from the scene. Okay, moving onwards, because I want to get to the other two. Are there any other questions you have about the similarities here? Okay, we're going on to the story of Bathsheba. And just if you could tell me what page it is in your source sheets. Is it 11? That's where we're going to be starting now, actually page 12. Oh, so the one last point that I didn't mention yet is the idea of the root that Abigail, who's coming from Shevet Yehuda, is going to be connected to Ruth, but even more so David is going to be connected to Ruth. And there's a similarity in the chesed that Ruth does for Naomi in helping support Naomi when they come back to Beit Lechem. Abigail is doing a chesed by making sure that David doesn't go off to battle. So almost this element, this thread of chesed that Ruth has done, David is now going to reap the benefit by what Abigail is going to do for him as well. Okay, now we're looking at Yehuda and Tamar as similar to David and to Bathsheba. I think in the interest of time, I'm going to just take you through the parallels so that we can get to the end of what we're trying to do. So if you look with me in the Yehuda and Tamar story in Pasuk Zion, we have a phrase which only appears twice in all of Tanakh. The first time is here. The second time is going to be in the David and Bathsheba story. And the phrase is Ra be'enei Hashem, that it was bad in the eyes of Hashem. What is bad in the Yehuda and Tamar story is the fact that Er is behaving inappropriately with Tamar. Er is Yehuda's son. According to the Pshat, we don't know exactly what is going on. The Mefarshim have fun trying to fill in the different loopholes. That would be for a different shiur, but just to know that that term appears, that something is not quite right in how they are behaving. And we are told also that after David has Uriah killed, also Vayera Beinei Hashem, his putting to death of Uriah is considered bad in the ways of Hashem as well. When you look at the two stories, if you look with me in Pasuk Yud Bet, Yehuda's first wife's name is? No, that's his daughter-in-law's name who becomes his second wife. His first wife's name is? Shua is his father-in-law. Bathsheba, which sounds remarkably like Bathsheba, which is an interesting correlation as well. And in fact, in the Divrei Hayamim parallel, Bathsheba is referred to as Bathsheba. So another way that we're linking the two stories together. There's a death penalty that appears in both stories. In the Yehuda and Tamar story, who's about to be put to death and for what reason? Tamar, because for adultery, for harlotry, she is supposed to be waiting for Shelah to grow old enough to marry, following the laws of Yibum, levirate marriage. But somehow she got pregnant and she's going to be judged without a trial and put to death when she doesn't deserve to die. What is the death penalty in the David and Bathsheba story? Also as a result of Uriah, but this time rather than the woman, Bathsheba, being put to death, her innocent husband is going to be put to death. Right, for what has...
David gives himself a death sentence when he's initially given the analogy of the sin that he's committed when the prophet comes to him.
Okay, so he's going to be given a death sentence, not necessarily for, yes, for him, and then it's waived, but his children certainly seem to suffer. He's going to pay the penalty through watching many of his children die as well. Both women, when they discover that they're pregnant, are the ones to go and inform the father of their child about their impending pregnancy. It's an unusual discussion. It's an unusual transfer of events. Tamar doesn't go up to Yehuda and say, hi, guess what happened? But she certainly lets it be known, I'm pregnant to the man who owns this staff and this ring, by which Yehuda recognizes, oh, I am that man, and admits to his deed. Bathsheba actually sends messengers to inform David, I am pregnant with you. And we have a similar aha moment with David when David listens to the mashal that Natan is going to give him, when David listens to the rebuke that Natan is going to give him and says, oh, the person who committed the sin deserves to die. Natan is able to say, Ata ha'ish, you are that man, and David is able to admit it as well. So they both are able to admit that which they did to the action that they had been involved in. Who is born to Tamar and Yehuda as a result of the story? Peretz and Zerach, the two twins. How is that connected to David? If you follow the genealogy, and I gave you the genealogy from Sefer Rut on page 14, thank you, you'll see the connection between the two. Okay, from that story, what can we then learn about the two? Again, that the stories are going to help teach us about the characters of David and Bathsheba. What can the parallel to Yehuda and Tamar help us understand about the two? Give you time to think, or just let me...
Yehuda recognizes that he did something wrong, and he takes responsibility for it, whereas when David realizes that she is pregnant, Bathsheba is pregnant, his solution is to try to get Uriah to sleep with his wife so that they'll think that he was the father of the child, and when he refuses to do so, he arranges for Uriah to be killed in battle by going in the front lines.
But ultimately, he does take responsibility.
At the end, but after doing something terrible.
Okay. I've been doing a lot of reading lately on the whole David and Bathsheba story, and there's some interesting perspectives as to why David was acting the way that he did, and I'm going to share two totally different approaches, but always trying to figure out what was David trying to do by sending Uriah back home to try and cover up what David had done. So possibility number one is that he was concerned with the child. The child, he wanted to be born into a legitimate family, almost to the extent even if he couldn't be the father, he wanted to make sure that there was a father who was going to acknowledge the child. We first meet Bathsheba when she's washing herself on the roof, and the rabbis inform us that she seems to have been going to the mikvah, which meant that she wasn't pregnant beforehand. And if she's suddenly pregnant when her husband gets home, obviously, he's going to start questioning who the father is. So by sending Uriah home, it's as if he's trying to ensure that this Uriah will recognize this child as his, even if he knows that it's not, and that that was David's main objective. And the rationale for this is the story of the two women with Shlomo, where they're both claiming ownership of the baby, and one mother says, you know what, I don't care who takes this baby, I just want the baby to be alive. I don't care, David is almost saying, who's acknowledged to be the father, I want to make sure that this baby has a father. So that's one way of looking at it. A complete opposite way of looking at it is that Bathsheba was no longer married to Uriah. There's an understanding in the Gemara that any soldier who went out to battle during the time of Shaul and David would write a conditional divorce to his wife. In the event that he was captured, in the event that he was killed but his body was not found, this divorce would go into effect, so the woman would be divorced and free to remarry. There are a lot of indications that Bathsheba's marriage was indeed over. If we look at how she mourns for Uriah when he's finally killed, it's a very calm, a very passive, oh, she mourns for him. She mourns for her Baal. She Baal versus Isha, Baal, and Ish can all both mean husband. Baal is more the owner, Ish, more of a personal relationship. She mourns over her Baal. And if you look at how Yaakov cried over Rachel's death, how Avraham mourns over Sarah's death, it's very parva the way she's mourning over Uriah, which is going to lead people to think that the marriage was over. So David, by sending Uriah home, wanted Bathsheba to say, we're not married anymore. What do you think you're doing here this night? Proclaiming that the marriage was over, so to help legitimize what they've done.
So what I would say is, because that's, to me, very, very bothersome, because then, I mean, so I'll start. One of the other similarities is you have the beginning of the Yehuda story is Vayered. He goes down, and we see that he's leaving his family, and leaving his family we often see is, and look what happens, the mess that transpires. David sends his army off to war, and he's sitting around watching women bathing on the rooftop. So he also has lost his, has gone off, has lost his bearings, okay? He's doing things he shouldn't be doing. He should be the king. He should be out there with his soldiers. And he ends up sinning. And we know he sins. We can make up all the excuses we want, but he wouldn't be admonished by God if he hadn't sinned. So you said she had a conditional divorce. She had a conditional divorce. Her husband wasn't dead. David made a grave sin. I mean, we can find all the excuses we want. It's very bothersome to find excuses for a grave sin like that. And then the child dies. I mean, God is speaking. I think it's fair to say.
Did you have a comment? You wanted to say something?
No,
Okay, sorry. Yes, David is not acting up to par at all. It is very clear by the fact that he's staying at home. When all the other kings are going out to war, there is something not right. He's taking a nap in the middle of the afternoon. Like, what is he doing asleep at this time? It's totally a negative. What's interesting, though, when he's rebuked, it's more a rebuke for what he did with Uriah necessarily than with Bathsheba. And I'm not condoning what he did with Bathsheba. And as I said, I just read this entire book on trying to figure out what exactly David had done with Bathsheba, whether it was allowed, what aspects of it were allowed, and what aspects were not. Some interesting things to note, and this is on page 17. The source from Gemara Shabbos, Ved ishto lakachta lecha leisha, lekuchin kidushin yesh lecha ba, ki eina eshet ish. The fact that he was able to marry her, now this is really coming when he's marrying her, not when he's sleeping with her. But if it was adultery, there's a problem with a future marriage between the two pairs of adulterers. So the fact that later on this marriage is considered legitimate seems to shed retroactive light that what he had done with her previously was okay. And again, the Gemara is going to jump through hoops trying to figure out what was okay. Part of the discussion is, when does this conditional divorce take place? Does it happen from the moment that he's not returning home? And from that point forward, does it happen from the moment he's not returning home retroactively? So the moment that he's dead, that divorce goes into effect from the moment that it was given. Was she really divorced? Was she even really wed to Uriah? In another bizarre Gemara, where they're going to try and show three generations being born within 24 years, they're going to put Bathsheba at age 8 at this point, that she was really too young when she married Uriah. They had never consummated the marriage. He, as this gibor in the army of David, was off to fight Aram, Edom, Ammon. He was away from home for many, many years, which also questions his conduct, since one of the exemptions for soldiers during the first year of marriage, he's supposed to stay home and take care of his wife. So we can question what he wanted out of this marriage if he was abandoning his wife to fight the many wars that he did. That possibly she never consummated the marriage with Uriah, which is why she never had a child with him, which makes it somewhat, again, they're all trying to figure out to put it into a better light, and it definitely was not a stellar moment in David's life. The question is how bad it was. The fourth way that they try and figure out what David was able to do is by suggesting that Uriah was not Jewish. He's Uriah Hachiti. Either he was Uriah from the nation of Chet, which means that he would have had to convert, or he was Uriah who lived amongst the people of Chet. He was Jewish and just given the name because that's where he's coming from. If it was the former, Uriah Hachiti, that he converted, the problem with that is that converts were really not accepted during the days of David at all. It was considered that David was so powerful that he would be converting out of fear. It wasn't considered a legitimate conversion. So again, one possible explanation for what David has done is that he didn't consider Uriah to be, his conversion to be valid. Therefore, Bathsheba was not considered to be an Eshet Ish. Therefore, he was not sleeping with a married woman at that point. Again, does he do the right thing? And if you look at the top of page, sorry, the bottom of page 16, Ruya hayta bat sheva leDavid misheshet yemei bereishit ela sheba ela b'machov, that there was an understanding that Bathsheba was designated to be David's wife already from the beginning of creation. The problem was how he went about ensuring that she would be his wife. There's this understanding also, it's a very similar to the Tamar and Yehuda story, that Tamar knew that she should have a child from Yehuda's family, and she tried to do it in a legitimate manner by first marrying Er and then Onan, and she was willing to wait for Shelah. But when she saw that Shelah wasn't being given to her, then she took matters into her own hands to get herself pregnant by Yehuda to make sure that there was a child, doing whatever was necessary. Again, not justifying David's action, but putting them in another light. Okay. What we have so far, then, are the three wives for whom we have a huge story about. We saw Michal, and we saw a really stunted relationship between David and Michal, where Michal is very passive, where she's literally given as a pawn back and forth between different men, where David seems to have married her in order to cement his own royal standing. We see David and Abigail, where there's a lot more recognition that they are partners in this marriage. When Abigail tells him something, he respects her, he's willing to listen to her. We just don't see that much of her because her son is going to fall off the face of the planet for whatever reason, and she's not going to be involved anymore in the story. We see a lot with David and Bathsheba. There's a question of how passive Bathsheba was in this process. It seems to be that David is taking her, and as king, she has no voice in the matter, and that she is compelled to sleep with him. But there's also the verb batavo Bathsheba, that she seems to have some voice in what she's doing as well. She wasn't only responding to what David said, that she might have wanted this union as well, which is an interesting side to her. There's an interesting midrash as well that shows a gumption to her we don't necessarily see in the pshat, that after the first child died, when David wed her and wanted to resume having relations to her, presumably, the Midrash gives us this dialogue, she refused to sleep with him. Look what happened the first time around. Is this what's going to happen to all of her subsequent children? Wherein David had to promise her, no, I'm going to have a child with you who's later going to take over the throne. Whereupon Bathsheba agreed. And when the child was born, Hashem is almost stamping his stamp of approval. He sends Natan to name the child Yedidya. Shlomo's other name is Yedid Hashem, the friend of Hashem, helping to prove that what they are doing is actually condoned by God. And Bathsheba then will make reference to this at the end of David's life. When Adoniyahu wants to take over as king, she's going to be egged on a little bit by Natan, but she's going to go to David. You promised me. What's going on here? Do you realize what's happening? Adoniyahu is about ready to declare his monarchy. David, really with his last bit of energy, is going to right away call for Natan, call for the Kohen Gadol to take Shlomo down, to proclaim him king. Every ceremony that can be done is going to be done with Shlomo so that there's no doubt in anybody's mind. And again, we see a very strong Bathsheba, and we see David responding to her and acting upon her advice. There's no doubt about it that David and Bathsheba represents a low point in David's life where he's acting the way that he shouldn't have been acting. And if we want to see that he's able to go beyond it, perhaps the best way is the last time we see him in conjunction with a woman in the beginning of Melachim Aleph, and this is with Avishag. And what's interesting here is use of the similar verbs that we saw with the David and Bathsheba story, but with different effect. With David and Bathsheba, David is the one seeing Bathsheba. He sees her. He wants her. By Shlach Malachim, he's going to send for her and really do everything he can to get Bathsheba into his room. At this stage in his life, when he clearly needs some help in order to warm him, it is the servants who are acting on his behalf. We see the same exact word. We see the verb Vayishlach. But David is very passive. Okay, I might need this, but I really don't want to have a hand in it. Not only that, v'hamelech lo yeda'a. He does not have relations with her. They're staying together in a bedroom, in a bed, day in and day out, and he's able to overcome his desires, really showing a complete tshuva, a complete reversal from the way he conducted himself with Bathsheba. When they're looking for Avishag, it's almost as if there's a beauty contest. They're sending out servants amongst the nation to try and find the most appropriate woman. And if you look at the parallel sources, again, all of these stories have parallels. The parallel is to Ahasuerus, where he's sending out for replacement for Vashti. He's sending out to find Esther, and the words, the verbs are very similar. Ahasuerus's servants go out to find a wife for him, and he's going to test her out. He tests out all of the women. They come at night, they leave the following morning, and he's going to choose the best one. Again, we have a stark contrast between the way Ahasuerus is behaving, which probably was more normal for the time, to the way David is behaving and the restraint that he is showing. And it helps to show if Bathsheba was indeed, and it was, a low point in his life, and especially how he dealt with Uriah, the many ways in which he rises above it and overcomes it in later life. So really, this is going to conclude our brief look into David, starting with a snapshot in the beginning of his six wives and his six sons, his six different contenders for the throne, the tensions that probably existed, who he's marrying, why he's marrying them, who these women were and what they represent, to a little bit more of an in-depth look into the three and then four, which is a common biblical strategy, the three women that he does marry again and his different relationships that he enjoys with each one, versus Abishag, which brings it, flips it over. What we might have imagined would be another David story is really going to be a different one. And if nothing else, the character of David is an extremely complex one. We can't judge him just based on the David and Bathsheba story. Yes, that's a major part of him. But to look at him as the be-all and end-all, this is who the king was, is going to negate what we've seen with Michal, what we've seen with Shaul, what we've seen with Abigail, what we see when we read Sefer Tehillim. So I hope you've enjoyed our little snapshot and brief view, and thanks for learning with me this morning.